Look at the closest piece of steel to you right now. I mean, like a nail, a car chassis, maybe a desk leg. It looks entirely dead, right? Just rigid, permanent. But what you're actually looking at is a frozen microscopic battleground.
Yeah, a total snapshot of this violent Apomic choreography that was just stopped dead in its tracks.
Exactly.
The everyday world really is kind of an illusion when you zoom in far enough. I mean, you look up and you see a singular steel beam holding up a roof. You definitely don't see the billions of microscopic arenas trapped inside it.
Right, where atoms had to, negotiate, migrate, and sometimes violently force their way into entirely new configurations just to cool down.
Exactly. It's wildly dynamic under the surface.
Which is why our mission for this deep dive is to decode that hidden inner life. We are examining excerpts from HKDH Padesi's text, Interpretation of the Microstructure of Steels. And our goal here is to basically uncover the exact physical movements of atoms that cause wildly different microscopic structures to grow inside the metal.
Because ultimately, how those atoms move completely dictates whether the bridge you drive over stands strong or, well, snaps under pressure.
Okay, let's unpack this. Where do we actually start when we want to understand the anatomy of steel before it cools?
Well, we have to start with the parent phase, right?
Yeah.
The origin point for all these transformations. So when steel is glowing hot, it exists in a state called austenite.
Austenite.
Right. And at the atomic level, austenite has a face-centered cubic crystal structure. And rather than just, sounding like textbook jargon, picture a microscopic cube of iron atoms.
Like an atom at every corner and one right in the middle of each face of the cube.
Exactly. And this specific shape leaves relatively generous gaps. So it provides these perfect little pockets where smaller carbon atoms can just comfortably tuck themselves away.
Right, but the dropping temperature totally changes the rules of the game. The steel cannot stay as austenite.
No, it can't. It's physically impossible.
So it forces the iron atoms to rearrange themselves into completely new, tighter phases. And usually that means becoming ferrite, which has a body-centered cubic structure.
Meaning an atom in the very center of the cube? Yeah. Which leaves much less room for the carbon.
Right. Or it becomes cementite, which forms a completely different orthorhombic crystal. The atoms literally have to migrate to new coordinates. So let me try an analogy here to map out how they make that shift.
Look for it.
Imagine those austenite atoms are all out on a dance floor, right? Executing this highly structured, perfectly synchronized square dance. Everyone has a partner, everyone holds a specific spot on the grid.
I like this, yeah.
But suddenly, the music stops, the temperature drops, and a new song comes on, demanding a completely different kind of dance.
Right, so what do they do?
Well, some of those atoms realize they simply cannot do the new dance in their current formation.
Yeah.
So they completely break their holds, scatter across the floor, randomly bump into each other, and, slowly form new, smaller groups in totally different spots.
Yeah, and Padesi formally categorizes that scattering movement as the reconstructive mechanism. And he actually introduces a similar analogy that maps perfectly onto your dance floor. He compares it to civilians boarding a bus.
Oh, civilians boarding a bus. Okay.
Yeah, so when a queue of civilians gets on a bus, they do it in a completely uncoordinated manner. Every shred of correspondence between where they stood in line on the sidewalk and where they sit inside the bus
He's just erased.
completely erased. They wander to whatever seat they prefer. So in metallurgical terms, atoms break their bonds and move in a random diffusion-dominated manner.
Which takes time, right?
Exactly. It takes time. And the atoms completely rebuild the metallic structure from the ground up.
But what if the music changes, but the atoms refuse to let go of their neighbors? Like they don't have the time or the thermal energy to scatter, so they try to force the new dance while stubbornly holding hands.
Well, then you trigger the displacive mechanism. Sticking to Boadicea's terminology, this is the military transformation.
Ah, soldiers on a bus.
Exactly. Imagine a platoon of soldiers boarding that exact same bus. They don't wander, they board in a highly disciplined, rigid order. The person who is standing immediately to their left in the queue outside will end up sitting immediately to their left on the bus inside.
So near neighbors, stay near neighbors.
Precisely. In the steel, this means the atoms shift into the new crystal phase without ever breaking their overall atomic order. It is a highly disciplined, strain-dominated movement. What's fascinating here is that this single difference, whether the atoms board the bus as wandering civilians or marching soldiers, completely and entirely dictates the physical properties of the steel you interact with every day.
Okay, let's follow those wandering civilians first.
Yeah.
When they actually have the time to break bonds and slowly diffuse, They create what is probably the most famous architectural product in steel, which is perlite.
Perlite, yes.
The text describes perlite as a mixture of two phases, ferrite and cementite, just growing cooperatively side by side at a single moving front.
Yeah, so as the steel slowly cools, a colony of perlite begins with a microscopic seed of ferrite nucleating. And that little seed immediately triggers a particle of cementite to nucleate right next to it.
Oh, so they kickstart each other.
Basically, yeah. And from there, they grow together, cooperatively pushing forward into the parent austenite. Because it's a civilian transformation, the carbon atoms have plenty of time to diffuse out of the tight ferrite and pack themselves into the cementite, which can hold a lot more carbon.
Okay, but I have to challenge how the text initially presents the visuals here. Because when you look at the optical microscope images of perlite provided in the source.
The 2D cross-sections.
Right, these flat 2D cross-sections. It looks exactly like a stack of alternating layers. A flat layer of ferrite, a flat layer of cementite, another layer of ferrite, like a microscopic deck of cards.
It does look exactly like that, yeah.
Yeah, but Padeshi insists on calling an entire massive colony of perlite a single bicrystal.
Mm-hmm.
Calling a huge stack of supposedly separate layers a single bicrystal feels, I don't know, entirely contradictory.
Oh, it totally does. But it is actually one of the greatest optical illusions in metallurgy. You are looking at a 2D slice, which forces that deck of cards perspective. The text offers this brilliant 3D analogy to shatter that illusion.
Okay, let's hear it.
Imagine a whole head of cabbage. That cabbage represents a single, continuous crystal of cementite.
A cabbage, yeah.
Right. All of its leaves are connected at the base, right? It is one complex, folded, continuously branching shape.
Mm-hmm.
Now imagine taking that entire cabbage and plunging it into a bucket of water.
Oh, wow. So the water represents the single crystal of ferrite.
Exactly.
It flows into every single gap between every single leaf of the cabbage, perfectly interpenetrating the structure.
Precisely. So a 2D slice right through the middle of that bucket would look like alternating stripes of green leaf and clear water. But in three dimensions, all the green is one connected cabbage and all the water is one continuous body.
That makes perfect sense. So all the cementite is a single crystal, and all the ferrite is a single crystal. They interpenetrate to form a true bicrystal.
You got it.
But why does this cabbage and water structure actually matter to the listener? Like, what does this mean for the structural steel holding up their office building?
Well, it dictates the baseline strength and toughness of the metal. If you force that perlite to grow faster by cooling it just a bit quicker, those leaves of the cabbage grow physically closer together. The text calls this a finer interlamellar spacing.
And the closer those layers are, the stronger the steel becomes.
Exactly. The tight interfaces act as physical roadblocks for dislocations, meaning they stop the internal atomic layers from slipping past each other, which is what prevents the metal from deforming under a heavy load.
Okay, so the tighter the leaves, the stronger the steel. But the text makes a critical distinction here, right? Stronger doesn't necessarily mean tougher.
No, it doesn't.
Because that entire colony of perlite acts as one giant crystallographic grain, you know, one continuous cabbage and water system. A crack doesn't have to navigate a maze. If a crack starts to propagate, it can slice straight through that entire colony, completely undeviated.
Exactly. There are no changing grain boundaries to deflect it. It just unzips.
It just unzips. Wow.
Yeah, that continuous structure is a huge double-edged sword. Sometimes that tightly packed perlite makes the steel too strong for practical use. Manufacturers often need to machine or cut steel, and fine perlite will destroy industrial drill bits in seconds.
Right, so it becomes an energy game. By holding that perlitic seal at around 750 degrees Celsius for an hour and a half, we give the atoms a massive thermal budget.
Yeah, they want to minimize the surface area between the ferrite and cementite.
Because maintaining those large flat interfaces requires a huge amount of energy. So the flat leaves of the cementite cabbage break down and retreat into tiny spheres to conserve energy. The text calls this ferroidization. The steel softens up and the drill bits survive.
That is the civilian diffusional process at work. But, you know, what happens if you strip away that thermal budget entirely?
Here's where it gets really interesting. If you've ever seen a blacksmith plunge a glowing red sword blade into a barrel of water in a movie, you've watched them force a completely different mechanism.
Oh, yeah. Classic quench.
They plunge the temperature so violently fast that the atoms drop below what the text calls the MS line, the martensite start temperature. The civilian mechanism is shut down instantly.
Right. The steel is freezing rapidly, yet the atomic structure is still desperate to transition to a more stable phase. It doesn't have time to diffuse, so it is forced to execute a military maneuver. The atoms collectively shear and snap into a new formation without any diffusion whatsoever.
And this creates martensite.
Yes, an incredibly hard phase called martensite.
But snapping into a completely new crystal lattice without actually rearranging your neighbors causes immense macroscopic deformation, right? The text refers to this as an invariant plane strain.
It does.
It cites a shear strain of about 0.25 and a dilatation of 0.03. To translate that math into physical reality, imagine taking a perfect microscopic square of metal and violently skewing it so a full quarter of its width shifts completely sideways.
While simultaneously forcing it to expand by 3% in thickness.
Right. All happening near the speed of sound inside solid metal.
The physical forces involved are just staggering. To survive that immense internal stress without just ripping the surrounding atomic lattice to shreds, martensite cannot grow in big chunky blocks. It is forced to form as incredibly thin, needle-like plates or laths.
It has to stay slender.
Yeah, it stays as slender as physically possible to minimize the overwhelming strain energy it's generating.
There is a fatal flaw to this military maneuver, though, because when the civilian atoms were building perlite cabbages, they were breaking bonds and rebuilding completely. They wiped the slate clean.
Literally erasing the old austenite boundaries as they grew.
Right. But the military transformation is entirely confined. Because it maintains strict correspondence with the parent structure, these newly formed plates of martensite are entirely trapped within the original grains of the austenite they nucleated in. They cannot cross the borders.
Which means those original austenite borders actually survive the quench. The text describes this vestige as the prior austenite grain boundary.
You can think of it as a ghost boundary haunting the steel.
That's a perfect way to put it. And those ghost boundaries aren't just spooky, they are massive structural hazards.
Because a grain boundary is fundamentally an area where the crystal structures don't perfectly align.
Yeah.
It's a high-energy, stressed zone.
Exactly. So solutes like phosphorus or sulfur naturally migrate to these high-energy fault lines to settle. They act like a sponge for detrimental impurities.
And this causes a phenomenon called impurity embrittlement. You end up with a microscopic fault line totally saturated with impurities. So if a sudden physical stress is applied to that steel, say a sudden impact on a car chassis, the grains can separate right at those ghost boundaries with almost zero energy absorption.
The steel won't bend, it won't stretch, it will simply shatter catastrophically.
Which is terrifying. So we know we can make steel tough with slow cooling, or ultra hard but brittle by quenching it fast. But engineers usually need both. They need a compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And nature actually provides a loophole to get both, creating what we might call the rule breakers of metallurgy.
Yes, the rule breakers. The most prominent hybrid phase is bainite. It is fascinating because it utilizes a sequence of both mechanisms.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, it begins as a military displacive transformation. A plate of ferrite violently shears into existence without any diffusion, exactly like martensite. However, because the cooling rate is just a bit slower than a strict water quench, shortly after that plate forms, the carbon atoms realize they are trapped in an incredibly tight space.
So they diffuse.
Exactly. They perform a civilian movement, partitioning out into the surrounding residual austenite.
So it's like a microscopic 1-2 punch. First, the military shear of the massive iron atoms, then the civilian diffusion of the much smaller carbon atoms.
Right. And the temperature dictates exactly how far that carbon can run.
If the temperature is a bit higher, the carbon escapes completely into the surrounding area and forms cementite between the ferrite plates, creating upper bainite. But if the temperature is lower, the carbon is sluggish. It gets trapped inside the newly formed plate, forming cementite right there, creating lower bainite.
Spot on. Then we encounter the strangest rule breaker detailed in Padacci's text, which is Widman-Stettin ferrite. The source classifies this as a periquilibrium state.
Periquilibrium.
Yeah, it's a bizarre compromise entirely dictated by the physical sizes of the atoms involved.
Because steel is mostly large iron atoms dotted with much smaller interstitial carbon atoms.
Right. So in Widman-Stettin ferrite, the heavy iron atoms are forced to move in a disciplined military fashion because they lack the time and energy to diffuse.
But the carbon atoms are so small and fast that they manage to move in a civilian diffusional manner at the exact same time. The entire displacive growth of the iron plate is actually controlled by how fast the tiny carbon atoms can run away ahead of the advancing interface.
It's wild. And because those massive iron atoms are still executing a military shear, it generates that exact same massive strain energy we saw in martensite.
But an individual plate simply cannot survive that much stress on its own, so it solves the problem mechanically. It forces the simultaneous nucleation of two back-to-back plates.
Yeah, they grow at the exact same time, but their crystal orientations are essentially mirrored.
Picture two people standing back-to-back, pushing against each other with identical force. The physical shape deformation of the left plate perfectly cancels out the shape deformation of the right plate.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this mutual accommodation completely mitigates the strain energy. And because they grow back to back, pushing aggressively against the surrounding structure, they force the surface of the metal up into a distinct tent-like shape.
A tent-like shape.
Yeah, metallurgists can actually physically observe this tent-like surface relief under a microscope.
Which forces a critical question, right?
Right.
We are talking about tents, cabbages, and ghost boundaries that exist purely at the atomic level. How do scientists actually see any of this to verify these theories? I mean, you don't just put a piece of bridge steel under a magnifying glass.
No, definitely not. The microscopy techniques are just as ingenious as the physics they observe. For optical microscopy, metallurgists have to chemically treat the steel to reveal the structures. Like, if they need to differentiate bainite from untempered martensite, they use a chemical etchant called needle.
And the needle basically targets the weakest links, right? Since bainite is a complex mixture of ferrite and cementite, it is full of thousands of tiny, messy interfaces.
Yeah, it's very chaotic.
So the needle etchant aggressively attacks those chaotic boundaries, causing the bainite to burn away and appear very dark under the microscope. But martensite, lacking those complex carbide precipitates, resists the etch. It appears light, boldly displaying the distinct straight edges where its plates originally sheared into existence.
That's exactly it. The text also highlights a purely physical technique called thermal grooving to expose those dangerous, invisible prior austenite grain boundaries we discussed earlier.
Right, the ghost boundaries.
Yeah, scientists take a highly polished sample of the steel and hold it at the austenitization temperature, which is around 930 degrees Celsius.
Because those ghost boundaries are stressed fault lines where the crystal structures clash. So when you heat the metal up to 930 degrees, you give the surface atoms enough mobility to relax.
They essentially pull apart at those specific fault lines to balance out the surface tension where the boundary hits the air.
Meaning the metal literally carves microscopic valleys or grooves into its own surface. It draws a physical map of its own hidden structural weaknesses. That's incredible.
It really is. But, you know, optical techniques hit a hard wall when it comes to resolution. The text discusses Euler maps, which use electron backscatter diffraction to map crystallographic orientations.
And they work perfectly for larger structures.
Right, but when martensite plates get down to thicknesses of just 0.2 micrometers, the electron beam physically spreads out too widely. The beam hits multiple incredibly thin plates at the same time, severely compromising the data.
So when the details get too small, they abandon scanning techniques entirely and rely on transmission electron microscopy. Or TEM. TEM shoots electrons entirely through an unfathomably thin slice of the sample. It is devastatingly accurate, revealing individual nanoscale atomic arrangements.
But the trade-off is brutal. You can only view an infinitesimally small area of the metal at one time.
Like, you can see the bark on a single tree perfectly, but you have absolutely zero idea what the force looks like.
Exactly. You lose the macroscopic context entirely. But the microscopic precision it affords is what allowed scientists to confirm these exact atomic mechanisms in the first place.
So what does this all mean? We began this deep dive by asking you to look at the steel in your daily life. What Badish's text reveals is that those supposedly rigid, solid objects are actually vast archives of thermal history.
That's a great way to summarize it.
By simply changing how fast a piece of glowing hot metal cools down in a factory, engineers dictate the rules of the microscopic dance floor. They dictate whether the atoms board the bus as wandering civilians or highly regimented soldiers.
And that single microscopic choice fundamentally dictates whether the metal in your car will bend to absorb an impact or whether it will shatter. The macroscopic engineering of our entire civilization relies entirely on manipulating this invisible atomic choreography. And this raises an important question.
That's it.
If manipulating these military versus civilian atomic mechanisms purely through cooling rates allows us to perfectly engineer the strength, flexibility, and brittleness of steel.
What if we could apply these exact same trap-strain concepts to entirely different fields?
Right. Could there be a martensite equivalent waiting to be discovered in engineered polymers or even synthetic biological structures? Imagine unlocking entirely new classes of supermaterials, you know, plastics that rival titanium or synthetic bone structures that never break, simply by figuring out how to rapidly freeze their atomic dances.
Wow.
If we can force steel atoms into military precision to hold up a skyscraper, what other microscopic universes are just waiting for the right thermal trigger to transform our world?